stand by for action.
Gamer's Haven Special Edition.
This is Ethan with the Gamer's Haven Podcast at gamershavenpodcast.com. And I had the distinct pleasure to sit down on the phone with Mr. George R.R. Martin. Now, you all should know him from, if you've been listening to our show, we have the tendency to drone on and on and on about how much we love his Song of Ice and Fire series. Well, I was lucky enough to get 30 minutes of his time from his very busy schedule, and to talk about his history in gaming, and to talk about his work as a writer, of course. So, and as always, if you hit our website at gamershavenpodcast.com, you'll be able to find a link to a special section in our Amazon store of this time, obviously, Mr. George R. R. Martin's work. So visit our website. Sit back and enjoy a very special and a very, very exciting interview I had with Mr. George R. R. Martin.
In conclusion, I would like to point out that it's time for a revolutionary new look in primetime and variety podcasting, and the combination of Aaron and Shay can bring this to the world. Yes, for over 20 years, Shay here and the dedicated group of people that make up the Red Phone Zone have been developing the art of internet entertainment to heights were never before considered possible. And at the same time, Aaron here has been developing and creating ardent opinions of movies, comic books, and all things geek-related. From the same creative minds that brought you Giant Ketchup, the Iffy Shay Show, and Super Nerd Night, these two giants of the industry have fused their creative juices into one great explosion of brilliant internet programming. And what is this fusion of creative juices called? The Red Phone Zone, a show that will be loved and adored by every Alexa home in the country. Small children will love the cute, cuddly characters. Young people love the fresh and innovative comedy. College kids, intellectual eggheads, will love the underlying symbolism of everything. Freaky, long-haired, dirty, cynical nerds will love that we are freaky, long-haired, dirty, cynical nerds, because that is what show business is all about. Yes, and when the show hits, the careers of the men who made it possible to put the show on the air will skyrocket. People like John Hamm, Brad Hunstable, and even Dr. Gayla Thayer will become stars in their own right. The names of these men will become household words like stove, sink, toilet, no, like patriotism, apple pie, and mother. Friends, the United States of America, no, the world needs a Red Phone Zone, and you should download this show. Now, we're not pulling punches here. I mean, there's nothing subtle about this pitch. So download this show and put it on your MP3 player, because we'll all be famous. The Red Phone Zone will be famous, and Ustream will be famous, because we'll all have a hit show in our hands, and we'll get all temperamental and hard to work with, but you won't care, because we'll all make a lot of money, and Aaron and Shay will be happy, and you'll be happy, and the Red Phone Girl will be happy, and God will look down on us and smile on us, and he will say, let them have a 40 share.
Aaron, why don't you just say, Red Phone Zone, 8 p.m. Central at redphonezone.com.
Broadcasting Wednesday nights on Ustream.tv. This is Ethan with the Gamer's Haven Podcast, and I am thrilled to be on the phone with Mr. George R.R. Martin. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing very well. I'm pretty busy yes. These days, but beats the alternative, right?
Yes, and I can already tell you I'm not going to ask the question that everybody has been asking you. So
that's good.
Which, because we already know the answer, is we'll get it when it's done. for those of our listeners who don't know, George R. R. Martin is the author of the much raved about Song of Ice and Fire series that myself and my co-host Jeremy go on and on about loving, as well as books The Dying of the Light, The Armageddon Rag, and Dead Man's Hand, along with being editor of several more of the Wild Cards books.
Yeah, I've been editor of the entire Wildcard book since the beginning of the series. Where
so, oh, you're the
going
editor
on now, like 24 years, I think, that Wildcard has been running. So it's probably my longest running project.
Well, since we are a gaming podcast, I'd like to sort of hit real quick on a bit of your gaming background. As I understand it, you are a gamer.
Well, if a gamer is someone who plays games, yes, I am
exactly.
A gamer. I play games, of course, as a kid. When you know, I'm incredibly ancient, so we're talking about the 50s here. I played games back then a lot, like the board games, Monopoly, Risk. I was an addict for Risk, Diplomacy. When I got a little older, betraying people and stabbing in the back. It was good practice for writing Game of Thrones in my later books. Playing a diplomacy for a few years, and I was a chess player, quite a serious chess player, I suppose you could say. I was president of the chess club in high school and college, and captain of our chess teams, and so forth. And then when I got out of college, I actually made my living from chess for a few years, directing chess tournaments, not as a player, but as a tournament director. Mm-hmm. So I was very big in the back in the 70s there in the whole world of chess. And then role playing games, of course, is I got into really when I moved to New Mexico in 1980, and fell in with a group of writers down here, Melinda Snodgrass, Walter John Williams, Victor Milan, John Miller. They had a gaming group already set up where they were playing games like Call of Cthulhu and the Morrow Project, and they invited me to join them. So that's when I started role-playing games. So those are mostly the areas in which I game. I have played some video games from time to time on my computer, but I'm not really big in that
sure.
area. I haven't played many video games.
Right.
My expertise is more role-playing games and those older kind of games, those board games and things like that.
Okay. Now, how has gaming been an inspiration for your writing?
Well, most notably in Wild Cards is where it came in. As I'd mentioned, I fell in with this gaming group when I moved to New Mexico. And mm-hmm. we played Call of Cthulhu a lot. We played Morrow Project. We occasionally played a few other games. I think Paranoia we played a few times. And then one year for, when you play in a role-playing group, eventually you get the urge to be the game master instead of just one of the players. And I got that urge. I ran a little Call of Cthulhu campaign for the group. And then one year for my birthday, Vic Milan gave me a copy of a superhero role-playing game, because he knew I was an old comics fan. And it was called Superworld, written by Steve Perrin. And so Vic Milan gave me this Superworld game, and I started running a superhero role-playing game for the group. And, not everybody in the group was a writer, but I'd say about three-quarters of the people in the group were professional writers, professional science fiction fantasy writers. So they were very creative, and we didn't do any of the scenarios in the books or anything like that. We invented our own scenarios. I invented my own scenarios, and they came up with some great characters, and the game was an enormous amount of fun, and it basically took over our lives. We would start playing, and we would play till like 4 in the morning, and then we would post-mortem what we had just played, and it would be dawn would be coming up before I got in my car to drive back. And then we started, playing twice a week, or sometimes three times a week. And especially for me, it became hugely addictive. Possibly aided by the fact that this was right around the same time where my fourth novel, which was a book called The Armageddon Rag, a mm-hmm. rock and roll novel, had been a colossal commercial failure. It gotten me my biggest advance of my career, and it was supposed to be my breakthrough bestseller, and instead it was a total flop. So suddenly I was the opposite of hot. In publishing, as in many other entertainment fields, you're only as successful as your latest project. And
sure.
The Armageddon Rag field, I couldn't get arrested anymore. I couldn't sell my next novel and all that. So I found that I was devoting all my creative energies into Superworld. And I actually lost like a year and a half there, I think, where I did nothing but run this game for people. But I finally reached a point where I said, you know, I'm going to be homeless on the street rolling up villains here unless I get control of this. And I said those fateful words, there has to be some way to make some money out of this. And because we had such great characters and we were having such fun with the adventures. Now, at that time, we're talking the early mid-80s, in the world of science fiction fantasy books, the shared world was very popular. There was Thieves' World, which was run by Robert Asprin and Lynn Abbey. And right. There were a number of Thieves' World imitations, Leavec and Ithkar and War World and The Fleet and all that. But no one had ever done a superhero, so I came up with the idea of pitching Wild Cards as a superhero shared world. And, you know, I had always been a comic fan. I'd been, as a kid in the 50s and 60s, I collected comics, I read comics. My earliest stories were published in comic fanzines back in the 60s. So there'd always been part of me that had this secret desire to write about superheroes and all that. Sure. And a lot of the group were into that, too. Now, once we decided to do it, we, of course, there's like a switch that you have to change in your head because... What makes a good game does not make good fiction. You know, any editor can tell you that they get things coursing their desk all the time that are obviously games that someone has written up. Someone has played a session of Dungeons and Dragons, and they had a lot of fun doing it. Now they've written it up as a short story, and they've sent it in, you know, and it's become sort of a joke among professional editors that the minute they get a manuscript on their desk, which is about a thief and a barbarian and a cleric all meet at an inn, they know that someone has just written up their latest D&D adventure. So we couldn't just write up our games. We had to rethink it. And to that mind, we did a lot of brainstorming. Melinda Snodgrass came up with the idea of the wild card virus, so we would have one thing that would... trigger the entire universe instead of a bunch of different arbitrary things as in a superhero universe. And I reached out to people who had not been part of the game because right. we had like five or six writers, but we needed more than that. So I recruited Roger Zelazny and Howard Waldrop and Ed Bryant up in Denver and a number of other very talented writers who joined us and created some great characters of their own. And the rest is, history, as they say, I guess. The first Wildcard book came out in 1987, and Volume 1, and I'm presently still working on Volume 21, which I hope to deliver in a month or so. So it's become the only surviving shared world from the glut of them that existed in the 80s, so we must be doing something right.
Yep. And speaking of Wild Cards, you just recently had a release on that one. That was...
Well, Wild Cards has been, over the years, very successful, not only as books, but in spin-offs. Oddly enough, we started as a game, and then it became a game again. Initially with Steve Jackson Games, who licensed the rights back in the early 90s.
Right.
And more recently with Green Ronin, who are doing Wild Card supplements as part of their line of Mutants and Masterminds.
One of our personal favorite games, in fact.
Oh, okay. Well, have you played the wild card scenarios?
I have not, but I own them all.
Well, that's good.
It's just like you have your own superhero, you have the wild cards universe. I've had mine for about 10 years, so that's what cool. I generally run in.
Cool. Yeah. So it's done that, and we've also had wild card comics. Again, we did a series with Marvel Epic back in the late 80s, early 90s, and now we're doing a new series with. Initially, the Dabble Brothers, and now Dynamite has taken it over and is finishing
it.
So we hope to continue with that after this initial Wild Card miniseries runs its course to have another Wild Card miniseries. Different characters, but the same universe. I mean, Wild Cards, since we have like 30 writers involved, it's not just a series of stories about one character. It's a whole world, like the Marvel Universe or the DC Universe. There are hundreds of characters at this point. And so we have a lot of different stories we can tell, funny stories and horrific stories and exciting stories. All sorts of forms are open to us because we have the richness of an entire universe.
Sure. Well, moving on, we'll come back and touch on wild cards here briefly. But one thing I definitely want to talk about is the novel series that I know I've fallen in love with just recently is The Song of Ice and Fire.
Yes.
And it has very, really sort of permeated a lot of aspects of not just obviously your work, but also the licensing aspect, because it's now in three different formats as a game, being a card game, a board game, and a role-playing game.
Yes, and it's had several incarnations in some of those. You know, the role-playing game, initially we had it done by Guardians of Order, who did a beautiful leather-bound limited edition and a trade edition of their...
Was a gorgeous book. I remember when that came out.
Yeah, unfortunately, then they immediately went bankrupt.
Yes.
So that didn't work out too well for Guardians. Hopefully, the fans who got it enjoyed it. And now, more recently, Green Ronin has picked up that license, and they're doing a new series of things, which seems to have been very well received.
Which is now, I think, it's been nominated for an Origins Award, actually.
Oh, has it? Excellent.
Yes, those nominations came out yesterday, and it was on there.
Oh, well, you're telling me something I didn't know. I'll have to look that up. And you know, besides that license, we have there's a wonderful series of miniatures based on Ice and Fire
that have come out from
Dark Sword Miniatures, and of course, Fantasy Flight has done. Initially, they did a collectible card game, which was very successful, and more recently, they've switched to a different format card game, a living card game, I think they call it, and they've had a board game with several supplements, and they're doing an adventure game, so. And they've done an art book, so Fantasy Flight has had a whole group of Ice and Fire spin-offs coming out, and I'm going to be coming up in November to Minnesota, where they're headquartered to do. They're doing a Days of Ice and Fire, a big event Fantasy Flight is sponsoring with tournaments and all of that, and I will be part of that as a speaker and so forth.
Well, with The Song of Ice and Fire, the first book came out back in 1996, if I'm correct.
That's right, yeah.
And the last one, of course, or the most recent one, I should say, came out in 2005.
Right.
How do you, I want to know personally, is how do you keep that all straight in your head, that series?
with increasing difficulty.
Oh, man.
I mean, way back when I first sold the series... I had envisioned a trilogy, just three books. And, of course, you know, Tolkien once wrote about Lord of the Rings. He said the tale grew in the telling. Because when he began that, it was just going to be a sequel to The Hobbit. It was going to be about the same size as The Hobbit. And it grew into this enormous epic thing, of course. Well, my books also grew, and they expanded considerably beyond three books, and the plots grew more complicated, and... that's one reason I've slowed down. I mean, you haven't asked a question, but I know it's on all the readers' minds. Why is the one taking so long? Well, you know, I'm juggling an awful lot of balls here, and I do find myself referring back and forth frequently and scrabbling through my notes and trying to remember things, which is somewhat new for me. I mean, I've been a writer for a long, long time, but I've never done a multi-book series of this scale before. And I can fairly confidently say I probably will never do it again once I finish this one. Most of my other books, The Armageddon Rag and Fever Dream, Dying in a Light, these are all standalone novels, just one novel. And while I have done series, nothing on this scale. So the complexity of the world and all that, it's part of what the fans enjoy about it, I know. And I do enjoy it myself, but it's time-consuming and it's difficult. So that's some of the stuff that I'm wrestling with.
Now, one thing that is really prevalent in The Song of Ice and Fire is very vivid characters. How do you go about developing characters like that? And in a gaming aspect, we look at that sort of as doing, you know, NPCs type of thing. So and developing just a player character. So how do you go about developing a good character?
Well, there's no easy answer to that, but, you know, as a novelist and writer of short stories and all that, I've always felt that characters are the heart of fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you sometimes hear science fiction called the literature of ideas. And I know there's a school of thought that feels that, you know, the scientific ideas are the heart of science fiction. But I've never agreed with that. I agree more with Faulkner, where he said that the only thing worth writing about is the human heart in conflict with itself. And to that mind, I do try to create fully fleshed three-dimensional characters. Good guy. I mean, there are certainly good guys and bad guys in my fiction,
mm-hmm.
But they don't tend to be, you know, the Dark Lord of ultimate evil who just gets up in the morning and say, ha ha ha, now I'm going to do evil, because I don't actually see people like that. I mean, the worst people in history thought they were heroes in their own mind,
sure.
And the best people in history had moments of doubt, moments of fear, moments where they made mistakes and did something stupid or something selfish. You know, we all of us have the capacity in us to do good and evil. And we may do a heroic act on Monday and a really nasty thing on Thursday. We're more heaps of contradictions, all of us. And I try to reflect it in my characters.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I draw on characters from history that I've read about, sometimes real characters that I've read biographies of or I've read histories about, sometimes even fictional characters, mythological figures. I look around at people I meet, people in the news, public figures, friends, of course, who I tend to know a little better. And ultimately, you have to draw on yourself. I mean, mm-hmm. What really animates every person, especially those that are viewpoint characters, where you're inside their skin looking out at the story and not just someone you meet along the way. A viewpoint character, you know, the only one person that anyone ever really knows is themselves. You know what's going on beneath the face that you present to the world. You know, mm-hmm. You may not, you know, say certain things, but you may think them. You may have moments of doubt and temptation that the world never knows about because you conceal them pretty well. So it's always a question of empathy, and it's a question of reaching into yourself and putting that out there to infuse some life into the characters that you're creating.
Sure. Well, with A Song of Ice and Fire sort of exploding onto various formats right now, I know you're only tangentially involved in it, but HBO has just recently announced they're picking it up as a series. And I believe, if I remember reading your LiveJournal right, you were out on the set recently, weren't you?
Yeah, we filmed the pilot back in October and November.
Mm-hmm.
We shot some, it was all filmed abroad. We shot some scenes in Scotland, a number of scenes in Northern Ireland, which is in the Belfast area, which is our main base of operations, and then we shot the Daenerys scenes down in Morocco. So I visited all three locations and, watched the pilot being filmed. At that point, we had no series order. It was just a pilot, so I wasn't about to miss that. It was sort of a once-in-a-lifetime experience to see these things come alive. But now we have indeed been picked up for a full season, one season. Of course, mm-hmm. Other seasons are possible if we do well, but it'll all depend on, you know, ratings and the critical reception, how much buzz the show generates.
Sure.
But we're hopeful. Our plan, of course, is to do the entire series, but to do it, each book will be one season.
Mm-hmm.
So this first season of 10 episodes will cover the first book in the series at Game of Thrones.
Sure. That's awesome. I know when they announced it, I actually, when they announced they were doing the pilot, I hadn't actually read the books yet, so I'm a recent convert.
Okay.
We mentioned a bit of the licensed properties that you're working on, especially with Song of Ice and Fire and with Wild Cards. How involved are you with the licensing process of your work with these companies?
Well, I'm involved to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
I usually have some rights of approval.
Right.
Because I wanted to guarantee a certain standard of quality. to these products and that they were true to the books to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have time to do them myself, of course. I can't. I'm still writing the books, which is the main thing. And I will also be writing one script per season for the HBO series. So that's another obligation. And I do other things like editing wild cards and occasionally writing for it. I couldn't take on, you know, writing games and things like that. And some of them, frankly, I don't have the expertise to do.
Sure.
But I reviewed, like, for the role-playing game, I review the text of the adventures and mm-hmm. all the rules and the stats and all that I leave to the gaming companies.
Mm-hmm.
I frequently review the arcs for a lot of Fantasy Flight's products and for Green Ronin product and consult with them about which artists we should hire and, you know, which artists we should rehire when they do a good job for us or not hire when they don't do a good job for us. So I'm involved in that extent. I work with Dark Sword, people talking about the miniatures, which I actually collect miniatures, and that's sort of a passion of mine. So mm-hmm. I'm probably more involved with them than with some of the others just because that's a particularly strong interest of mine that I get enthused about. We have a series of collectible sword replicas from Valerian Steel. Mm-hmm. I consult on all of those as well. You know, I mean, to be perfectly honest, sometimes I wonder whether that's wise of me to be involved even to that extent, because had it just been one license, you know, it sounds easy. Well, you just have to approve these things. But
sure.
I do have a number of licensees, and some days I have, like, you know, 20 approvals that are backed up here. Mm-hmm. Things I have to review, adventures I have to review, art that I have to look at, and I fall behind, and it does take time away from the other things, perhaps more than I had anticipated. But, you know, I'm into it now. I can't hardly stop.
Mm-hmm.
I could, you know, waive my approvals and just say, okay, you know, here's your license, send me the check. But
sure.
I'm not willing to do that. This is still my world, and the books are separate. The books are canon. These products are secondary products, but I still want them to be high quality, mm-hmm. and I want them to not, you know, violate. I don't want my readers who buy a game or a replica sword or anything to be disappointed in it because it has strayed too far from
sure.
from the books.
Well, moving on, I'd like to talk a little bit about you're a prolific writer, and you put very rich material out. How do you approach writing something like the Song of Ice and Fire series?
Well, you know, I don't think I'm that a prolific writer. If you compare my output to that of people who broke in 1971, the same
sure.
year I did, you'll find other writers who have five times as many novels published in that same period as I do. So I'm a fairly slow writer. I've always been fairly slow. And I've slowed down more in recent years, I think, because of the size and scale of these products,
sure.
these books. You know, the only way you can approach writing them is the same way you approach writing anything is one page at a time, one paragraph mm-hmm. at a time, one sentence at a time.
Mm-hmm.
If you try to concentrate too much on the overall thing and how much you still have yet to be due, that's kind of can get into your head and slow you down even more. I mean, so I just try to lose myself in a world when I'm writing. I boot up my computer and I go to Westeros. I rewrite what I wrote yesterday, and I just say to say, okay, well, here's this scene. How do I write this scene? What word? What's the next sentence?
Mm-hmm.
What word do I use here? And I take a fair amount of care over that. I rewrite a lot, all this makes it a slow process, but it's worked for me. It's done all right for me. Fans seem to like the results, and besides, I'm too old to change. So there we go. That's my working method, and I'm going to stay with it.
All right. And you mentioned that Song of Ice and Fire was originally going to be was originally envisioned as a trilogy, and obviously now it's got four books out, and you're working on the fifth.
Yeah, 7 books is what I'm looking at now.
7 books what you're looking at. Did you find yourself while you were writing at least those first couple of books that you were sort of fighting against the writing itself to make it a trilogy, and then it just sort of exploded out?
Yes, I certainly, especially as I approached the end of the first book, mm-hmm. I was struggling to try to get to where I wanted the first book to end, and you know, I had like 1,300 pages, and I wasn't even close to the end. So I was like, "Well, this is not going to work," you know. So I wound up splitting that first book into two, and then saying, "Well, okay, now it's going to be a 4-book series."
Right.
And then, even by the time I finished the second book, it was clear that the same thing was happening. So, but in the early days, I did struggle. You know, you always. There are certain constraints on the length, which is, you know, there's physical constraints on how big a book can be.
Sure.
I mean, beyond a certain level, the binding won't hold together anymore, and the pages fall out, which readers tend to find annoying. And then there's also the issues of price points, which concerns publishers more than writers, I suppose. But publishers worry if you have a really big book, you have to put a significantly high price on it to pay for all that paper and the binding, and you know, you can only get 3 of them in a stack at the bookstore instead of a slimmer book where you get 12 of them in that stack. So these are all issues that affect them, but the writer can't worry about that sort of stuff. The writer just has to say, how do I best tell the story? Okay, I'm telling a story about these people. What happens next? And what should happen next? What scenes do I have to show? What scenes can I summarize or skip over or imply? And those are always the kind of issues that I wrestle with.
Mm-hmm. Now, being that you've worked in novels for quite some time, you've also done material for television, for Hollywood, and for comic books, if I'm not mistaken. What can you tell us about that sort of a creative process and how it differs from novels, from writing a novel?
Well, I haven't actually done much in the way of comic books, a little bit, but yes, I spent 10 years out in Hollywood working in television and film. And
that was on the Beauty and the Beast show mainly, correct?
Well, it was 3 years on Beauty and the Beast.
Okay.
A year and a half on Twilight Zone, which was the first show I was on, the Twilight Zone revival of the 80s, then Beauty and the Beast. And then I did 5 years of what they call development, or sometimes development hell, where you're coming up with pilots for your own shows, or you're writing feature films. I did all of that. And that can be very lucrative, even more so than they're working on a television show, which is lucrative. Development is extremely lucrative, but ultimately, after 5 years, I found it also extremely frustrating because nothing ever gets made. You know, you're writing all these things, and the only people who ever see them are 4 people in a room, and for one reason or another, they decide not to do it, and you've wasted a year of your life. Well, not wasted, you've been paid for it.
Right.
You know, which is nice, but no one is ever going to see it. No one is going to see these scenes that you've crafted. No one is going to meet these characters that you've created. So around the mid-90s, I got out of that and returned to the world of books. Hmm. You know, writing screenplays is actually, to my mind, easier than writing novels.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. You're... You know, you need a good ear for dialogue. You need a strong sense of structure, since structure is very important.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't need to particularly write good prose. You know, you don't need to describe anything, because the set designer is going to do that. The director is going to do that. The director will frame the shot. The costume designer will put them in appropriate costumes. You don't have to describe what anyone's wearing. You don't have to describe what the office looks like or the room looks like. You don't have to create any visual cues. You know, you don't have to, there'll be a special effects person to do awe-inspiring matte paintings or animation or whatever you need in the way of special effects. You don't have to create it with words on the page.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easier in purely the craft. I mean, if you could just write a screenplay and when we finished, magically you would transform into a movie, that would be great. Or even if you could write a screenplay and work with all these very talented people who are into costume design and makeup and set design and all that. That would also be great. What's not great is the politics that's involved with it, because you know, you can't just write it and then get it made. You have to go through all these filters of, well, what does the studio think about it? What does the network think about it? What do the censors think about it? Oh, here's the notes from this person. Here's the notes from the other person. And if, you know, you don't address their notes appropriately, then many of these people have the power to stop it or to fire you and to bring in another writer who will address their notes the way that you want to do. So you find that not only... I mean, it's hard enough to come up with a good story, but then you have to fight for your story. Mm-hmm. And there are some people out there who are very talented writers, but they're not necessarily good fighters. So they have a hard time functioning in that environment. And I did okay out there. I can't say I did great, but the fighting after a while wore me down. You know, it's just endless. I mean, it doesn't stop,
sure.
Unless, of course, you become, you know, James Cameron or George Lucas or someone where you get mm-hmm. to be large enough that you can pretty well run your own empire.
Right.
But below that thing, you know, it's not only the artistic struggles, but there's the whole kind of political struggles that that go with it, and that's the part of Hollywood that I never liked.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on real quick to let's move on to some of your more recent stuff here. You just recently got out edited and put out a new collection called Warriors.
Yes, it's an anthology that I edited with my friend Gardner Dozois, who's the former editor of Isaac Asimov's science fiction magazine. Gardner has won the Hugo Award as best editor something like 17 times or something, so mm-hmm. he's probably one of the most distinguished editors in the field of science fiction and fantasy today. But Warriors is a bit of it's a big hardcover book. It's on sale now at your local bookstore, so
yep,
I hope all your readers
will. I saw it on the shelves yesterday.
Rush down and buy it. It's a bit different from most anthologies, though, because although there's some great science fiction and fantasy in it, it's not purely a science fiction and fantasy anthology. It is a cross-genre anthology. You know, when I was growing up in Bayonne, New Jersey, I bought, you know, I didn't have money to buy hardcover books, so the first books I read, besides comic books, were cheap paperbacks, which cost 35 cents back then. And there were no bookstores in Bayonne, so I got my paperbacks from a spinner rack, which was a little wire rack that was right next to the comic books, and you'd spin it around, and there were all the different pockets. And all the books in that were mixed up. You know, there were science fiction books and fantasy books, which I liked, but there were mystery novels, and there were romance novels, there were nurse novels, there were gothics. You know, some of these genres are dead now. There were spy novels, and of course there were classics of literature mixed in with that, Shakespeare and Dostoevsky and the Bronte sisters, Jane Austen, you know, paperback reissues of these things, and there were nonfiction books. So everything was all mixed together. There was no sections. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was actually very, very healthy, because, you know, although I was mostly a science fiction and fantasy fan, sometimes I would see a cover on a mystery novel or one of the classics of literature that I'd read about. Ooh, I read the Classics Illustrated of that comic. Let me try the actual book. And I would pick up these other books, and it expanded my reading. Well, now we don't have that. Now we have these bookstores, and everything is by section. And people don't read. There's some wonderful writers out there working in all genres and in no genres at all. So what Gardner and I did with Warriors is we contacted writers, not only just science fiction and fantasy writers, but romance writers and mystery writers and mainstream writers and writers of thrillers, and we said, tell us a story about a warrior. It can be in your usual genre. It can be in a different genre that you've always wanted to write in but never had the chance. It can be a hybrid of several genres. All it has to be is about a warrior, which, I mean, warriors are an archetype that's been with us since people have been telling stories. You know, I think literature began with Gilgamesh and Homer and the Iliad, all about war and warriors. So,
right.
And warrior stories exist in every genre. So that's what Warriors is. It's a It's a spinner rack in book form, and you'll find a mixture of stories there. You know, a Western. There's a Western in there. There's some great mystery stories there.
Oh, wow.
There's writers who are doing their working in their usual genre, and I have my own story in there is the Dunkin' Egg story, which mm-hmm. are sort of a side series I'm doing with Ice and Fire, set in the same universe but 100 years earlier.
Sure.
So the third Dunkin' Egg novella is in there. But Diana Gabaldon has one of her has a novella about her character Lord John from her popular Outland series.
Mm-hmm.
We have a Roman story from Stephen Saylor. We have Robin Hobb has done a historical, which is a little bit different for her. We have great stuff from Joel Haldeman and James Rollins, Howard Waldrop, numerous other people have done some terrific terrific things for us. So I hope your readers will give Warriors a chance.
I know. I think I'm probably going to head out tonight and pick it up, because that sounds awesome, actually.
Cool.
Now, is there anything else you have coming out or something on the horizon that that you're excited about or that we should all be excited about?
Well, I have another comic book series coming out from Avatar, which debuts April 16th. It's Fever Dream. It's an adaptation of my vampire novel, Fever Dream.
Oh.
And it's being done as a 10-issue comic miniseries
mm-hmm.
from Avatar Press. And I will be flying into Chicago for the Chicago Comics Expo there. I'll be one of their guests, and we'll be debuting Fever Dream there. I'll be signing all weekend at the Avatar booth at McCormick Center. So mm-hmm. If any of your listeners are in Chicago, they should definitely come on by and pick up the first issue, get it signed.
Excellent. And now we get into two questions that I generally always ask the people I'm interviewing. First one is very game-related. When was the last time that you got to sit down and roll some dice?
Oh, boy, it's actually been a few months since we last played a game. Probably about 6 months.
Well, and what was it that you were playing?
We were playing a space game run by my assistant, Ty Frank.
Oh, wow.
Original universe that he created.
Mm-hmm.
And which he actually has turned into a novel. So, but we're having a great deal of fun with the playing that game.
Excellent, excellent. And the last question I really have is, since part of what the Gamers Haven does is we like to sort of spread the love of the tabletop hobby and the love of, obviously, science fiction, fantasy, and really good storytelling. I'm just curious as to what about gaming, science fiction, fantasy, in this sort of universe that we're in here, what is it that you love about it? What is it that just makes you smile?
Oh, my God. I don't know. It's been part of my life for so long now. When I discovered science fiction, Robert A. Heinlein's Space Suit Will Travel, first science fiction book I ever read, mm-hmm. when I was in grade school. And I've been addicted ever since. I've never looked back. And, of course, later discovered Tolkien and Robert E. Howard, H.P. Lovecraft, so many good writers doing things. I love a book. I love losing myself in a good book. It becomes a vicarious experience where you look back at it later, and it's almost as if you live those things. I like to say that, you know, someone who doesn't read lives only one life, while a reader lives 100 lives.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel I've been very lucky in that way. And gaming is sort of the same, but it's, you know, you do it with other people.
Mm-hmm.
But the best games that we've played actually have very little rolling of dice in them. Our group does roll dice if necessary, but most of the time we're doing the role-playing part of role-playing very seriously. We're doing accents and you know, interacting with each other. It's almost like improv theater, and it's the games that go like that are my favorite games.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time out of your very busy schedule to talk to me and to talk to the Gamers Haven.
And you're welcome.
And I will hopefully get out to Conquest 41 and be able to meet you in person and say hi.
I'll look forward to that. And meanwhile, you know, do send me the an email when this is up, and I'll put a link to it on my website.
All right, we'll do that.
So, what do you do for fun?
Me? Oh, I play games.
Oh, I like games.
Whoa, no, I mean tabletop game. You know, with dice and stuff. You know, like D&D.
Measure!
Was it something I said?
Sir, I think you should leave.
Psst. Hey, buddy, don't worry. You'll find a Gamer's Haven around the corner.
The Gamer's Haven Podcast at gamershavenpodcast.com.
Been listening to the Gamers Haven Podcast. Subscribe to the show by visiting our website at gamershavenpodcast.com, where you can also discuss all things gaming in our forum, drop us an email, or just peruse our episode archives. You can also call us toll-free and leave a message to be played on the show by dialing 1-877-416-1270. That's toll-free 877-416-1270. On our website, you'll also find our actual play podcasts chronicling our misadventures through all things role-playing. Enjoy what you hear? Why not support the Gamers Haven by purchasing Gamers Haven merchandise, visiting our affiliates, or just by clicking on our donate button? The Gamers Haven podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 United States license, some rights reserved. Some music in this podcast is used with permission of Joe Hero Band at joehero.com. This is a Thousand Monkeys production.
This concludes the broadcast from World Control.